Call the Civil Law Committee to order. Quorum is present. Members, just a little roadmap. We've got just three bills here we're going to be doing today. The Smith bills that were removed because of a conflict. And we've got Representative Kelly's bill first. And I think if we can kind of keep ourselves in focus today, I think we can get these three done in our committee time. We did tentatively have a room for this evening. If we didn't have time or didn't get these done, that was more of a concern when we had two other bills we had also had on the agenda, thinking we could have gotten those five done as well. So just for the audience, we want you to try to keep your comments focused to the bill and the purposes in front of our committee. The second bill up, Representative Scott's joint physical custody. We will aim for about 15 minutes for the proponents and 15 minutes for the opponents to the amendment. That's a delete all amendment, and then hopefully 15 minutes for questions for the committee. And if we can try to stick to about a 45-minute time frame on that, I believe we'll be able to hit our targeted time of adjournment and not have to come back this evening. With that, Representative, first of all, the minutes from March 21st, is there a motion to approve them?
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Representative Scott moves the approval of the March 21st minutes. Any discussion? Having none, all those in favor say aye. Aye. Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. There's also March 16th minutes as amended. Is there a motion to approve them as amended?
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Representative Scott moves the approval.
Runbeck.
Runbeck, I'm sorry. Representative Runbeck moves the approval of the March 16th minutes as amended. Any discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Representative Kelly, House File 447, welcome to the Civil Law Committee.
Mr. Chair, this is Lesh. Before you begin, could I ask a question of the committee?
Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, we received notice of the specific bills that were going to be on today's agenda late Friday afternoon. I'm wondering how, under the committee rules, the minority is supposed to adequately prepare reasonable amendments to these bills when we have no more than a few hours, especially late on a Friday and early on a Monday, to get those done.
Well, Representative Lesh, I guess the way a lot of amendments are, but as for the timing, I can discuss that. Generally, if you have amendments planned for a certain bill, it's a matter of working on them over a period of time. Representative Kelly's bill has been out for quite some time. Representative Scott's has been out for some time. Representative Mazarol's, if that's the one you're referring to, it's a uniformed bill, but I haven't had any. Basically what we all have to do, you work with House research staff on getting an amendment and getting them an idea to a bill. But
Mr. Chair, understood. It's just that the timeline was very tight, and especially in light of the fact that it was late on a Friday and early on a Monday, it's difficult to get research staff together. These bills have changed over time, and we weren't necessarily sure which version was going to be on over time, so I just wanted to the committee chair to be aware of the fact that this was a concern of the minority. We did have some amendments that we thought would be reasonable in light of this, and there's no way to just orally move deletion of a part of it to do that, Mr. Chair. So I wanted you to be aware of that. This is something that we're discussing, and we hope you can watch that closer in the future.
Point well taken, Representative Lesh, and I'm happy to have a discussion with you offline. I understand it was about 2 o'clock on Friday that it was posted. Representative Lesh, I do know I've done it myself, emailed House Research, and that's part of the reason when we were contemplating rules, I modified and acquiesce to concerns that people were raising, and we have a three-hour rule deadline, which means 9:30 this morning. So that's another option, but I'm happy to visit with you a little bit further. I don't want to. I understand your point.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Lesh, do you have some oral amendments?
No, Mr. Chair, okay. We don't have any.
Feel free to raise them at the time if you want. Representative Kelly, welcome to our committee. The chair will move House File 447 be recommended to pass, and I understand.
What is that?
And be referred to the General Register.
Yes, sir.
Representative Kelly, if you want to present your bill, and I understand there's two components primarily that cover the civil law purview, feel free to spend emphasis the time on those areas, particularly adding this group to a registration list and having the records destroyed. But go ahead and present to your committee your bill, and hopefully we can focus on just those issues.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, and we certainly will. House File 447 is really an enhancement of the Vulnerable Adults Bill, and I think it certainly, as a lot of members here know, it's a good piece of legislation made better. And I will gladly admit in front of this committee that I'm not the expert in this room, probably Representative Hillstrom, who has spent countless hours on this bill, and I certainly appreciate it. Although I've been asked to shepherd this piece of it through, I certainly appreciate all the work that others have done before me. With me is Mr. Kevin Hansen from the State Ombudsman's Office, and he will discuss those sections that have to do with some of the data practices.
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Kevin Hansen. I'm an attorney and ombudsman specialist with the Office of Ombudsman for Mental Health and Developmental Disabilities. House File 447 is work that has been done by the Vulnerable Adult Justice Project, which is a group of about 25 to 30 public and private agencies that's been together since 2007 working on these issues. This group did work, like as Representative Kelly said, with Representative Hillstrom in 2009 to pass a bill largely related to financial exploitation. For discussion, it's important to point out quick who a vulnerable adult is in Minnesota. And there's two types. People who receive certain services like nursing home or other facility-based care or licensed home care are considered categorical vulnerable adults. And then there are individuals who have impairments which prevent them from meeting their basic daily needs and from protecting themselves from harm, and those are considered functional vulnerable adults. The majority of House File 447 is within the Health and Human Services area of law, but there are the provisions which you mentioned, which I'll briefly talk about now. Section 2 of the bill, of House File 447, requires facility staff members or employees who have been convicted of sexual abuse of a facility resident to register as sexual offenders under the Predatory Offender Law. The Predatory Offender Law, while initially written with a focus on children, was substantially updated in 1993 and 1994 to include crimes that involve adults, especially such as the criminal sexual conduct crimes, murder, and kidnapping. The law making it illegal for facility staff to have sexual contact with residents, however, wasn't written until 1995 and was never subsequently included as part of the list of crimes for which someone must register. The crime is very predatory in nature, given that these vulnerable adults often rely on facility staff to provide daily cares to them and provide necessary services. The other section of the bill that you mentioned is in Section 13, which requires the coordinator of the Vulnerable Adult Maltreatment Review Panel, which is an administrative panel reviewing allegations of maltreatment. It requires this coordinator, who is an employee of the Department of Human Services, to destroy not public data that the panel receives as part of conducting its review. Right now, what happens is the panel receives the information and then sends it back to the agency that initially sent it to them to begin with. So you see we have data traveling back and forth, and this would require less transmission of data between entities and allow the panel coordinator to destroy it. The only other provision of the bill that I'd quickly point out is Section 11, which allows a lead agency who's investigating maltreatment of a vulnerable adult to notify a healthcare agent. Currently, they're allowed to notify a guardian, but this would include a healthcare agent if their investigation is going longer than the time frame allotted for in law. And it's just to allow that healthcare agent to perform their duties as appointed by the vulnerable adult who would be the subject of the investigation. And with that, we're glad to answer any questions.
Any questions, members? Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Was there any thought of, in light of the data practices portion, of sending this to the data practices subcommittee?
Representative Lesh, we did contemplate that. John had a discussion with Chair Scott of the subcommittee, and our inclination was that this was a small enough issue that we could probably deal with, and also the author of the bill. The bill was moving, and it was after their last hearing that they realized they had to come here, and so we were trying to facilitate moving the bill for them on this matter.
Thank you. Just a question for clarification, Mr. Chair.
Any other questions? Members? Nope. Thank you. Any other testifiers, Representative Kelly?
No, Mr. Chair.
Is there any, do we have any other? We don't have any other testifiers for or against. Is there anybody in the audience that does want to testify for or against this bill? Representative Kelly, maybe your witness has the answer. Just what happens in the case of a wrongly accused party, or a falsely accused, or an exaggerated report? As I understand in reading it, it looked like there was a way to make the records, the reporter, public at that point in time. But otherwise, we're keeping the reporter's name pretty confidential.
Mr. Chair, that's correct. The reporter is kept confidential. If there is an first of all, if an allegation comes in, it is investigated by one of the three lead agencies, which is either Department of Health, Department of Human Services, or one of the 87 counties. And at that point, we hope that it's ferreted out whether it's a false allegation and what's really going on. And then after that point, when that investigation concludes, there are different appeal structures for the individual who might have been substantiated for abuse, neglect, or exploitation, or the vulnerable adult, which is this review panel that we were talking about. But I'm not sure if your question is more so if they intentionally make a false report and that comes to light, or if it's just a report somebody made in good faith trying to be proactive and it turned out not to be true.
Sorry.
Well, and it would just be an issue I would have a little concern with, just so we're, it seemed like the language dealt with that balancing act, but you know, family dynamics sometimes can play weird games, and there are sometimes instances where people have motives to harass somebody else's life because of something else that's going on, and so I just want to make you both aware of that, that I think that's an issue we want to make sure is, I understand the reason you protect reporters, because you don't want to incent them not to report, but we also want to make sure people are accountable, so when they're saying something, it's factual, and it makes the case go a lot better. Representative Runbeck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just looking at this handout here, it talks about the statewide, the number of reports in 2010, 22,000 reports of maltreatment, and to me that just sounds astronomical. So, I mean, what do we know about those? Have they been adjudicated? What's going on there?
Mr. Chair and Representative Runbeck, yes, those are the reports that come into, in each county we have a common entry point that it receives reports of maltreatment, whether it be abuse, neglect, or financial exploitation. So those are the reports. Mm-hmm. That's not necessarily those which have been substantiated that somebody did do something or unsubstantiated that someone did not do something. So what you see coming in might not even be maltreatment, but it's a report that somebody saw something funny, somebody was scamming through the neighborhood, or somebody fell inside their home and, you know, couldn't help themselves. So those are reports of, I've noticed something going on, not necessarily the outcome of those reports, if that helps clarify your question.
It does. I'm just wondering, do we know, or when, say that they're all, the reports are investigated, what percent of the 22,000 then actually would turn out to be material based on past experience?
Mr. Hansen?
Material maltreatment.
I am not qualified to answer that question, but we do have representatives from the Department of Human Services here who could answer that question if you would like or take their best stab at it.
Is there somebody from the department?
And again, a best stab might be the best.
Okay.
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Jerry Kerber, and I'm the Director of the Licensing Division at the Department of Human Services. And I'm sorry, I'm not able to answer the question about how many for the whole state, but for the Department of Human Services and the Department of Health, it's roughly about a third of the investigations end up substantiating maltreatment, 25% to 33%, somewhere in that range. And we can get some of those numbers for you. That are more accurate, and I'm not sure what it is for county maltreatment determinations, because counties are dealing with a little different situation where they're dealing oftentimes with self-neglect, where it might be an elderly person who's living alone and somebody reports that this person may be living in a neglectful situation, they have needs that aren't being met, and so it isn't so much always a case of substantiated maltreatment in those cases, but we can get you some of those numbers if you'd like them.
I don't know if I need numbers. I mean, I'm just curious about sort of the extent of the problem, and that's interesting. And you're saying that there are slightly different issues that are coming to each of the different lead agencies to investigate. But if you're saying one third of yours then would have resulted in a gross misdemeanor, you would have charged them through, and is that would that take place with your agency? Under this bill?
Mr. Chair and Representative Runbeck, I think it's important to note that what the investigation by either the county, health, or human services is doing is a civil investigation. It's a, if it's a family member, it's to see if they've done something inappropriate. If it's a licensed caregiver, it's to see if there's been a licensing violation, things like that. That's not exclusive of, but it's separate from the criminal process by which we have specific laws that relate to vulnerable adults. So there are times when the two work together and or overlap, and there are times when the two are separate from each other. So it's hard to say from your question which is always going to be, but there are two tracks that are going, and sometimes they do work together, sometimes they're separate from each other.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
So Mr. Hansen, what's happening to the people currently that are charged with this crime, and they're not on any sort of list?
And Mr. Chair, you're speaking specifically of the crime of facility staff member sexually abusing a facility resident, correct?
Right.
Correct. Right now, that is a crime, and prosecutors can charge that out, but it is not a crime for which somebody must register as a predatory offender if convicted. Unless we get this passed, then they would be required to register if convicted.
Mm-hmm. So are we expanding what the crime is here, or has this just been a omission in the current law? Is it the similar type of conduct that goes on between the alleged perpetrator and he breaks into a house and commits a sexual assault? They get reported as a sex offender, but right now they're not if they're in a nursing home, and it happens behind closed doors, and right now that's not being reported, but the same crime on the street would be?
Mr. Chair, depending on the crime charged, that would basically be correct. If it is, again, a facility staff member having sexual contact or penetration with a facility staff resident, it can be charged out and convicted, but it would not require that person to register. If your scenario, if somebody was charged with one of the criminal sexual conduct 1 through 4, similar to what you were talking about, then they would be required to register. So, yes, it makes a difference based upon where they're living, but this crime we see is because of the predatory nature of the dependency of the vulnerable adult relying on that caregiver for services and day-to-day activities in the nursing home or whatever facility it might be. It's a necessary crime to add to that list.
Very good. Any other questions, members? Anybody else in the audience that wants to testify in favor or against this bill? Having none, we'll proceed to vote. All those in favor, the chair will renew his motion to pass House File 447 to the general register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr.
Thank you,
Chair,
Representative Kelly. Representative Scott. As I said, Representative Scott, if you could present your delete all amendment to the committee, I would like to limit yours, your information and testimony to 15 minutes. We'll open it up for 15 minutes. I understand there's three people that have asked to testify. If there's others, we'll have to divide that time differently, but right now, if they could stick to 2 to 3 minutes, allowing the committee members to have some time to ask questions, I would suggest both sides try to keep your testifiers to 2 to 3 minutes, and we can try to have a vote on this about 1:45. And so, Representative Scott, you want to move your House File 322. Representative Scott moves House File 322. You recommended to pass and re-referred to Judiciary.
Yes, that's right, Mr. Chair. And then I would like to also move the A11 amendment to put it in the shape that we want it, to delete all.
Representative Scott moves the A11 delete all amendment. Please proceed and present that to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And also sitting at the testifiers table with me is Molly Olson. And we have put considerable work into this bill since our first hearing on February 8th. And we've done a number of changes to the bill, some minor changes, some structural changes, just to make it a better bill, we believe. We've removed redundancy of redundant words. We've reworded phrases to clarify and to make language more concise. One of the things that you'll notice that we did is on the notices that go out to all parties concerned, the notices we've shrunk those down in size. They're less wordy, and also we've largely expanded. Representative Holberg had several questions about endangerment of the child, and so we've largely expanded and included more specific situations that would be covered under that part of the bill. So we believe that it's larger in scope and provides more provisions under which the child would be protected. Looking at my notes here. We've restructured the bill so that there are more subdivisions and it's easier to read and to follow. And we also went through the entire bill with Senate and House research to check cross-references so that we feel that we have everything really tightened up well. Members, if you'll notice in your packets, is quite a big folder of information regarding joint physical custody and shared parenting. And we've Ms. Olson put this together, and I just want to thank her for her efforts here. There's a lot of information here. There's a very good table of contents that makes it really user-friendly. If there's any specific area of concern to you, there's documentation for that. And so with that, members, I guess I'd like to point out just a few of the major changes that we made to the bill. And I think I'd like to get started with that, if members have the bill there, or the delete all in front of them. A lot of the references, a lot of the changes that were made were just reference to the new section in the bill, which is 518.169. So the first one of the first changes was on actually page 2.15. We changed, we struck the word structured, which was a pretty vague term, and changed that to shared. If on page 4, you'll notice on 4.11 through 4.17, that is where we tightened up the language for the notice of custody and parenting time that is sent out to the parents of the child. Again, most of these changes have to do with just referencing the new statute. The guts of the bill really begins on page 7.9. We start with some public policy there. And this is, if you look at 7.15 and following, that is the areas of public policy. The next pages go into the actual presumption itself. And if subdivision 3 on 8.25 has to do with overcoming the presumption. And there you will see in 8.31 and following, you will see the criteria that I referred to earlier about child endangerment statutes. And I think it's really, it's very inclusive. And we've really done our best to make sure that that child is protected in every situation and that that presumption is not able to be overcome if there's any question at all that the child would be in danger. That really is the primary changes in the bill. We did also address, after the hearing that we had February 8th, we also addressed an issue that many people were bringing to us of the whole problem with geographic limitations. So, you know, if mom lives in St. Paul and dad lives in Moorhead, what do you do? How do you arrive at that equal number as much as possible? So we've addressed that in 9.23 through 9.34. And we're just saying that during the pendency of the custody proceeding that the child can't be moved out of their current school district unless the parents both agree otherwise. And then we're also saying that if it's just not possible to have that equal shared time, that the courts have to arrive at a minimum of 25%, but they're to try to make every effort to exceed that amount and to maximize the parental involvement with each parent. So we've really tried to work that out so it's a fair situation as much as can be possible. I guess I would just open it up for questions at this time. Those are the major changes that have been made in the bill. And if there's some other ones that you see that you'd like to ask about, feel free. And also, I'd just like to ask if Molly would like to add anything. Ms. Olson.
Ms. Olson, do you want to make some comments about the amendment, and then we'll open it up for some questions?
Well, I'll just, for the record, say that my name is Molly Olson. I live in Little Canada, Minnesota, and I come before you in my capacity as a concerned citizen. I am also the founder of a nonprofit organization called the Center for Parental Responsibility, which is a 100% volunteer organization, and our mission is to remove the obstacles that prevent both parents from being fully and equally involved in the lives of their children. And everything that I've done on family law reform issues is as an unpaid volunteer. And in the spirit of ensuring and promoting the best interest of children and celebrating the diversity of what each parent can bring, both the mother and the father, to their children, that is how we have arrived at this bill and why we're here today. And since the first hearing in February, I have been volunteering my time extensively to continue to get input from at least 15 different family law attorneys who are currently practicing law to get a better understanding of how this would be implemented in real life. I've also sought out as many of the committee members here today as who have expressed any concerns or questions about it as well. And I've also tried to seek out objections from the those that have opposed the bill. And in that process, we have taken all of the objections seriously, and we have tried to make accommodations in this version of the bill, in this amendment. We tried to make accommodations that will satisfy concerns and that will address the issues that have been brought up that people think this might incur, while maintaining the integrity of what we're trying to accomplish here. And also in that process, as Peggy had said, we've been very closely tied into House research and Senate research as well.
Thank you, Ms. Olson. Representative Scott, I understand there's two others that want to testify in favor. I'm wondering if we should have them come and testify, and then we'll have the 15 minutes for the opponents, and then open it up for questions.
You can do that, Mr. Chair.
John McGrath. Is he here? Mr. McCusker. Can identify yourself for the record. Try to keep your comments within 3 minutes, and welcome to our committee.
Thank you. I just want to say thank you, Chair and members. This is my first time testifying, so a little nervous. My name is Tim McCusker. I'm from Anoka. I'm here testifying in support of House File 322. Got a few comments here. Einstein was a wise man, and he said, "These two things I've always loved. We cannot solve our problems with the same thinking we used when we created them. And insanity is doing the same thing over and over again and expecting different results. I'm an engineer, and when I don't know how to solve a complex problem, I usually do what my common sense tells me. And here's what my common sense tells me. The current system does not serve the interests of families or taxpayers well. When two loving parents share nearly equal time with their children before divorce, why does the wave of a pen in a divorce proceeding change that? If consistency in a kid's life is of utmost importance, why does the current statutes and legal system not promote this to the greatest extent possible? And what is more important than the consistency of a parent in a kid's life? The existing system seems punitive to kids, parents, and family. And when you legally introduce conflict into a situation with lawyers and judges and court system machinations, expect lots of conflict. And if you follow the money trail with paid lobbyists who benefit, dare I say even profit, from the existing system and aren't necessarily doing it for the sake of kids and families, versus volunteers like Molly, who are taxpayers, who work every day and take their own time off, like myself, to attend to these meetings, and so they can try to expose and try to change the broken nature of the existing system. When you incentivize people to do something through a system of payments, expect more of the behavior you are promoting with those payments. And a system of dependencies on expensive government and court services has been created by previous legislatures and is now being paid by taxpayers and parents and families who cannot afford these services. And when academia and bureaucracy cloud the issue with cherry-picked statistics, clear the fog by spending a day in court, getting down in the trenches, and seeing for yourself how it really works, or if you enjoy poring over the statistics, review the meta-analysis like Molly has, which state clearly that joint physical custody works and mirrors family dynamics the best. Ask yourself a simple question from all the gathered experience of yourself, your family, your friends and colleagues. Does the current system really work for kids and parents and family? Is this a good design to create dependencies for kids, adults, and families? My kids are nearly grown. I've got one left. He's 16 years old. I've got three. One's graduating this year. The other one's already graduated. They're nearly out of the system, and that's what I refer to it as. It's kind of interesting. name for it system. They will someday have their own kids and grandkids and so on. It's my responsibility now, as it is yours, to try to change this broken system so that we don't have to leave a bigger, more convoluted mess for them in the future. We are responsible for whatever is decided, even if we decide to ignore it, but that would be an unwise thing to do. We can all walk away into the sunset with a clear conscience if we can but ask ourselves these two simple questions. Is it broke, and is there a better way? And that better way is joint physical custody. Please have the courage to change the existing system for families. And remember what Einstein said, insanity is doing the same thing over and over again and expecting different results. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. McCusker. Members, any questions directly for this witness? Having none, thank you, Mr. McCusker. Representative Scott, that's all we have for persons to, on the proponent side. Is there anybody else we've missed that you had intended to have testify?
Mr. Chair, we didn't line up witnesses because we felt like the committee had probably heard from several in the previous
correct.
Hearing.
Correct, and that was the understanding.
Yep.
Actually, I misspoke. I thought there was a couple that had asked to testify in opposition. Right now, we don't have anybody, but Representative Scott, I think we'll move to the 15 minutes for the opposition, and if there's anybody in the audience that wants to raise your hand. Is there people that are here to testify in opposition to this? Delete all? Three. Okay. If you want to plan to come up here, try to keep your comments to 3 to 4 minutes, and you guys can organize among yourself who wants to go first. You're welcome to come forward. Welcome to our committee. If you can identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Michael D. DeFerner. I'm the legislative chair of the Minnesota chapter of the American Academy of Matrimonial Lawyers. I testified regarding House File 322 back on February 8th, and I am here to speak about the amendments to the bill. I've sent an email to the members of the committee this morning at about 10:45. Outlining my concerns regarding the A11 amendment. Just to basically summarize what those concerns are, the A11 amendment does not ameliorate three of the major concerns that were raised at the committee hearing back on February 8th. The bill's creation of a financial incentive to litigate over custody and parenting time by tying the parenting time presumption to the child support statute, which has a lower amount of child support in cases of plus 45.1% parenting time. The bill's reliance on CHIPS, Children in Need of Protective Services, statutory provisions relating to parental unfitness and endangerment, which means that fault-based custody litigation would be encouraged because people will be trying to strap themselves into these very egregious acts of parents in order to defeat the parenting time presumption. And then finally, the requirement that the presumption be overcome by clear and convincing evidence, that type of standard, is going to create situations in which equal parenting time arrangements are going to be imposed in a whole bunch of inappropriate situations. I think one of the examples that was given was the 15-year-old child whose parent was never previously involved in that child's life, and now the county is seeking a parentage adjudication, and now that parent is insisting on their 45.1% plus parenting time presumption that they're guaranteed by the statute. More importantly, the revised language in A11 creates many new problems, which I'll show note as follows. Subdivision 2 of Section 9 of the bill on page 8 of the A11 amendment, lines 8.14 to 8.15, states that applies to temporary and final orders in marriage dissolution or, quote, parentage cases, end of quote. I'm not sure what the term parentage case is intended to mean. There are cases in which a county or an individual is seeking adjudication of parentage. The question would be, is that the intent by that term parentage case? Also, but what about cases in which the parent who the county seeks to adjudicate is ambivalent about what they want to do because they've really never had a prior relationship with the child? should they be encouraged into seeking equal parenting time at the very first hearing in that parentage case? Also, what about cases in which a father has signed a recognition of parentage and no adjudication of parentage is sought because the recognition of parentage has the full force and effect of an adjudication of parentage? Is that a, quote, parentage case, end of quote? One would tend to say no because that parent will not be seeking an adjudication of parentage and instead will only be seeking relief related to custody, parenting time, and support. Parent in that situation, they brings a petition for establishment of custody and parenting time. They don't bring a petition for adjudication of parentage in those types of cases generally. Then we have subdivision 3, subsection 1 of section 9 of the bill on pages 8 to 9 of the A11 amendment. It lists a number of circumstances under which a CHIPS finding under section 260C.007, subdivision 6, 14, and 15 of the juvenile court statute could lead to a finding of endangerment as being a grounds for rebuttal of the parenting time presumption. Subdivision 3.1, small Roman numeral 9, lists a number of examples of child endangerment convictions under section 626-556, subdivision 2C, as being separate grounds for rebuttal of the equal parenting time presumption. This is an expanded list from the previous, in the original bill, original House File 322. Some of these examples overlap with the CHIPS examples in section 260C.007 that are in the section 626.556. Others do not altogether. It makes for an extremely confusing review of statutes that are not normally referenced in child custody litigation. Then there are some examples of unrecited CHIPS categories in subdivision 6 of 260C.007, which are not examples of substantial child endangerment in section 626.556, subdivision 2C. Why shouldn't these factors be grounded for rebuttal of the presumption? They include placement of a child for adoption in violation of the law. That's in subdivision 6.7 of 260C.007. Growth delays caused by parental neglect, subdivision 6.10. Child's engagement in prostitution, where the parent hasn't actually placed the child in prostitution, sufficient to justify a conviction under section 626.556, subdivision 2C8. The child's commitment of a delinquent act before the age of 10, child's being a runaway, child's being a habitual truant. None of these would be the type of actions under the juvenile court statute that could lead to a rebutting of the presumption, all other things being equal. And then there's the types of behavior, bad parenting, that are not referenced under any of these statutory provisions. I'll just give you one that has vexed a lot of my fathers who are clients, and that is when they have been estranged and alienated from their children actively by the other parent. And as a result, they have gotten custody of their child modified to grant them sole custody. And under some of those circumstances, the courts have ordered that the other parent, the alienating parent that has lost custody, in order to give an opportunity for the child to basically be integrated into the what was previously the non-custodial father's household, they've required that the other parent's parenting time be restricted or supervised. Under this bill, the father would face a request from the mother that she should have equal parenting time, even though she's engaged in these estranging acts, because they don't fit within the statutory provisions that are referenced here. Then there is subdivision, or section 9, subdivision 3.1x, small Roman numeral 10, on page 9 of the A11 amendment. It provides for another ground for overcoming the presumption being domestic abuse as defined under 518B.01. However, the language in subsection A goes on to specify certain problematic exceptions. A couple of the exceptions state that if a petition for an order of protection has been dismissed without findings, or if the parties agree to an order for protection without a finding of domestic abuse, the court must find that no domestic abuse has occurred with respect to matters that were alleged or which could have been alleged. These exceptions are going to have the effect of endangering victims of domestic abuse and creating additional litigation. There are many victims who fail to show up at an initial order for protection hearing, either out of fear or because they have reconciled with their abusers. It's unfair and dangerous to forever bar them from claiming abuse under these circumstances. from the incident or incidents that caused them initially to seek an order for protection simply because they didn't show up. Moreover, many orders for protection are settled on the day of the hearing without findings. If a party is barred from later claiming domestic abuse in a custody proceeding because they agreed to an order without findings, they're going to be more inclined to litigate the order for protection in the first instance in order to achieve the benefit of that finding of domestic abuse, thereby creating an increase in court costs and delays. Subdivision 3, 1, Roman numeral 10.
Mr. Dittmer, we're at about 8 minutes, just so you know, and the other parties, that I don't know if you're coordinated with them or not.
That subsection B is also problematic in that states that allegations raised in the context of custody proceedings that do not display an evidence of a previous pattern of abuse deserve heightened scrutiny as to their veracity. This begs the question as to what would constitute a pattern and as to what type of evidence would display a pattern. What if there had been no prior acts of domestic abuse, but there had been a pattern of controlling behavior that had escalated into a single act of domestic abuse that precipitated the filing of an order for protection? Would that suffice? Next, turning to Section 9, Subdivision 3.2 on page 9 of the A11 Amendment, it gives us another basis for rebutting a presumption, being those situations in which, quote, the other parent is incapable of self-management or management of personal affairs and would jeopardize the safety of the children due to current habitual and excessive use of alcohol, drugs, or other mind-altering substances and the related actions due to the substance abuse demonstrate endangerment to the well-being of the child. This is a very heavy burden of proof, which makes it unlikely that you would be able to use chemical dependency or chemical abuse as a rebuttal of the presumption of equal parenting time. First of all, the use of chemicals, it has to be current under this language. Second of all, most instances the person will deny, because they're in a state of denial, and will deny using especially drugs. Second, the current use has to be both habitual and excessive. Thus, a person could claim that they may be engaged in habitual use, but the use is not excessive, or they could claim that their use was excessive on a couple of occasions, but it's not habitual. All in all, this is going to make it very difficult for a party to raise the other parent's active chemical dependency abuse as a justification for that parent having at least less than equal parenting time. And the Charlie Sheens of the parenting world, who deny that they are doing drugs anymore or doing alcohol anymore, are going to be able to make use of this provision's restrictive language. And finally, Section 9, Subdivision 4 on page 9 of the A11 Amendment provides for this geographical distances between parents' homes, providing a rationale for having less than 45.1% parenting time, but only if it would prevent the parents from keeping the child in one school during a school year. Apparently, the age of the child and an infant child's inability to tolerate frequent and lengthy travel between two parents' homes would not provide such a justification. Then Subdivision 4 goes on to provide that a child must remain in the same school district in which the child currently attends or most recently attended during the pendency of a custody proceeding, unless the parties agree or unless it's a domestic abuse situation. Unless this case falls within this specific exception, the court's going to be prevented from allowing a change of schools. Tying this provision to a school district also seems unwarranted in an era where many parents send their children to private schools or there's open enrollment and they're a different school district. Finally, the provision provides that 25% parenting time will be the minimum parenting time granted under this provision. Thus, the 25% parenting time presumption, which is currently a rebuttable presumption under 518.175 Subdivision 1E, is going to become an irrebuttable presumption, required in every case where geographical distance was the only factor statutorily warranting a rebuttal of the presumption of equal parenting time, regardless of the age or the condition of child. So these are just some of the concerns that I have from the A11 language that I wanted to point out to members of the committee.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Dittmerner. We've got two others that have asked to testify as well. So we've used up just over 10 minutes. So if the next two could come forward, probably together.
Chair Westerman, members. My name is Bruce Kennedy.
Okay.
I'm a divorce lawyer from Roseville.
And Mr. Kennedy, who's the other gentleman or person that wants to testify?
My name is Brian Sobel from Shorewood, Minnesota. Okay. I am also a fellow of the American Academy of Matrimonial Lawyers, where I'm currently the administrative vice president, and I practice primarily in family law and have done so for 25-plus years.
Okay. Do you both have coordinated testimony or similar testimony, or are you each talking to different parts of the amendment?
Chair Westrom, I haven't spoken to Mr. Sobel. I'm representing the Family Law Section of the Minnesota Bar Association.
Okay.
Different organizations.
Please proceed, and
I'll be brief.
We want to
previously expressed that we oppose the basic thrust of the legislation. and there's nothing, none of the changes have really changed our view of that, so we continue to oppose it. We keep hearing over and over again that the family law system is broken, and that is the need for this revolutionary change. But the statistics that were brought forward at the last hearing by the Center for Parental Responsibility indicated that 99% of divorce cases were settled before trial. And so we all hear of horror stories. There are horror stories of attorneys who were too aggressive or judges who were not caring enough and guardians who didn't do a thorough job, et cetera, et cetera. These things do happen. But by and large, the process works well enough that people settle their cases out of court, and we're just not seeing the need for a radical change in the law. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for your brevity. I forget your name. Brian?
Brian Sobel, S-O-B-O-L. I would mirror the comments of the other two speakers. The theme seems to be that somehow that we have a broken statutory scheme that needs a radical overhaul. We perceive the fact in the Academy through national meetings that we are viewed, the state of Minnesota, we are viewed as leaders in the country in family law. We are viewed as leaders in alternative dispute resolution. We have developed a system over the last decade that is spreading throughout the state, starting in Hennepin County, of reducing litigation to the level that Mr. Kennedy speaks of, that we literally never see contested custody hearings at the beginning of cases. We literally never have custody fights. The concern that we have is that this litigation, in fact, will encourage, not discourage, litigation, because you are going to have a vast number of people who are become panicked at the prospect of someone who hasn't been involved primarily caring for the children for whatever reason suddenly being vested with that authority, and it's going to create, we fear, a large volume of litigation. The concern we also have is that this litigation doesn't really recognize, it seems to be based on a presumption that somehow the family is served by joint custody. It ignores the fact that many, regrettably, many parents that we see aren't suited for joint custody for a number of reasons. Either they haven't done it, they've delegated it to another spouse, they aren't capable of doing it, they have mental health issues, they have chemical dependency issues, and the statute doesn't consider that. The statute sort of talks about the geography. They tried to correct the issue of geography, but it's only on a temporary basis, and what I could foresee happening now is parents, in an attempt to rebut the presumption, are going to start moving far enough away to try to create a situation where they were about the presumption. We have always focused on what is best for the children. That has been a primary factor not only in our state but in the statutory schemes of almost all of the states in the country that follow a best interest standard. This body and this legislature would be abandoning best interests by adopting this legislation. We feel that that is very, very dangerous. The fact that literally every family law bar association, the AML, the Trial Lawyers Association, have opposed this, should tell this body that there is something fundamentally wrong with this bill, and we would urge you to table the bill or give it more consideration before it is passed on.
Thank you, Mr. Sobel. We will open it up for questions. Representative Simon has a question, and I assume it's to one of these two gentlemen?
Well, not necessarily.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, although it could be. I'd like to hear from one of the opponents, but also from Representative Scott as well on a couple of these things. So, if it's okay.
Go ahead, and whoever it applies to, we'll ask them to come to the table.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I'm looking on the Delete Everything Amendment at line 8.30, the proof standard, which is clear and convincing. That's the highest you can get, really, in a non-criminal context. I guess a concern I have is, first, that it's that high, and second, you've got, starting on line 8.31 all the way over to the next page, in line 9.8, you've got a number of statutes from all over the statute books, and I'm wondering, I assume that I shouldn't assume, I'm wondering whether any of them have, absent this DE amendment, a clear and convincing standard. for example, you have a bunch of statutes. I'll just take the first one that comes up on line 8.33, abandonment under 260C.007. Then you've got others, 260C.301. Are those current standards of proof clear and convincing? And if not, if they're just preponderance of the evidence, aren't we then inserting a new clear and convincing standard into this existing list? In other words, if someone were to come off the street and assert a cause of action under 260C.007, if, absent this bill, in any other context of life, the standard is, a preponderance of the evidence, is there a danger in taking this list of many statutes and inserting into it, in this context, clear and convincing where it might not otherwise exist? I don't know these statutes well enough. For all I know, they are clear and convincing, or some of them are. But that would concern me.
Chair Westrom, Representative Simon, I think I can at least attempt to answer that question. We did go through the statutes very thoroughly with regard to all of these corresponding statutes that are listed in here. And our goal was not to change anything, but to be consistent with what is currently in statute. I don't have my statute book with me right here. It is in my bag, which I could go back and get, but I know that I have three post-it notes indicating at least three situations where clear and convincing evidence is the standard for these statutes we have referenced.
Sure. Representative Simon?
Okay, just to follow up.
Okay.
If I could, thank you. Because that would be a concern if we're basically in a backdoor way imposing a different and higher evidentiary standard into this list, and I take you at your word that at least three already have clear and convincing, then I guess that concern wouldn't be warranted. But for the others, I'd be concerned about that. And then what about the idea that I think Mr. Ditburner raised, which seems to be unfortunately, realistic hypothetical. What if you have a father who really wasn't involved in the child's life, and maybe that was part of the reason for the divorce? Maybe the parents have been living apart functionally for a long, long time. How do you answer that concern that Mr. Ditburner articulated, that spouse, that husband, would then be entitled to at least a 45% physical custody? Does that concern you, or do you think the language already takes care of that?
Chair Westrom, Representative Simon. Yes, that was an issue that was raised last time we were here with Representative Holberg. And we did take great pains to make sure that those situations were included. And they are included under the abandonment statute. If you look at those references, they both have very nice language already in statute that basically indicates if the parent has not been around or if they have not been fulfilling their parenting time. And that's why we included those. So that would be part of the current statutes that could be used to rebut the presumption, because we understand that can be a very valid concern.
Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just one more question about a different part of the bill. On line 9.32, the minimum of 25% if the parents can't agree in a school district and so forth. I don't know enough about the jurisdictional limits, I guess, of family law in terms of beyond the Minnesota borders, and maybe some of the practitioners here can speak to that. But what do you do if it's not just within Minnesota? What if one parent lives in Chicago and the other lives in Andover or something like that? What do you do in that case? And how do you shoehorn the 25% in that instance? Is it just that it's over the summer months when there's no school, or I'm just wondering practically how that would work?
Ms. Olson?
Chair Westrom, Representative Simon, yes, that is another very good question. I would guess that we have spent at least 10 solid hours on this paragraph for geographic limitations alone, trying to figure out language that would cover by far the majority of all situations that could possibly come up. There is no perfect way to handle these situations where the mother and the father do not live near one another. People that raise issues about this are always most concerned about, do they live in the same school district, and will the children be pulled out of the school or not? So we tried to keep those things in mind as we work together with a number of people on the language here. we did take into consideration all sorts of different situations. Maybe the mother lives in St. Paul and the dad lives in Mound. That can be just as difficult as if the dad is in Minneapolis and the mom's in Alexandria. We've thought about cases where mom's in Duluth and dad's in California. Really talked through and thought through all kinds of different situations that could come up. And the main thing here where it says if the parent, this is designed for parents that are both capable. They both are ready, willing, and able to share in equal shared parenting and joint physical custody with their child, but due to location, it's difficult. So in that case, we give discretion to the judge. And even though there's been some testimony that we're completely getting rid of the best interest criteria, the 13 best interest criteria currently in statute, we are not. And here's a fine example of how it will continue to be used. If we have two parents, one lives in Duluth and one lives in California, then it will be up to the judge on line 9.3. If the parents do not agree otherwise, the court shall determine which parent has the majority of parenting time using the best interest of the child factors under section 518.17. And to address your question, how could they possibly have that parenting time if one's in Duluth and one's in California? We have done a lot of different kinds of scenarios. In your packet that you were provided, there is a page of 10 different possible parenting time schedules that could be used, and within each 10 of those there's even a greater variety of possibilities. If you do the calculations for summer and say one is in Duluth and one is California, and you include all of the summers and you include the holidays and you include other key spring breaks and other times like that, vacation times, you can get up to the 25%. Another option that has been used in other states is when, for example, a parent is in Tennessee and another one is in Connecticut. Parents have agreed to alternate years. Maybe the age of the child 0 to 5, they're with the mom, and then children age 6 to 10, they're with the dad, or whatever. We're not dictating that. We're just trying to provide for a situation where that's up to the parents to decide how they would want to do that. And it's amazing how creative parents can be on their own.
I could maybe respond briefly, too. I have currently pending a custody case where father lives in Buffalo, Minnesota, mother lives in Plymouth, and the custody evaluator concluded that because of the geographical distance, a joint physical custody ward would not work. There was just too far of a distance. I've had another case, Brooklyn Park, a father, Lakeville mother. It just doesn't work. The research of Dr. McIntosh, I believe you might have been referred to it in earlier hearings. She's a leading researcher in Australia, who has found that such a law such as this simply doesn't work in certain cases. That's one of the leading bases as to why it doesn't work, geography.
Representative Hartman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I might need Mr. Ditburner to come back, but my question is for the author and then anybody else who can address it. What is the tie between this statute and child support? Because my understanding is there's some significance of 45.1 as opposed to 45, and I'm just curious about how that interplay works.
Representative Scott or Mr. Ditburner?
Chair Westrom, I can try to answer that as well initially, and you might want more information from someone else as well. Again, in your packet, there is a section on that. In your packet, in the table of contents, you'll see a section that is on Minnesota-specific questions, and there is a document in there about how this works together with child support. Our intention was not to change child support at all. Our intent was to make this completely separate and keep it completely separate, so no changes would have to be made to that, and no changes do have to be made to the child support provisions. Back in 2004 and 2005, when the income shares model was being addressed here at the legislature, and then in 2006 when it became the law, it was at that time that time and money were directly linked. never before income shares had time and money been linked. But at that time, it was, because how much time you have with the child does affect the child support, in that there could be a 12% reduction, depending on time between 10 and 45%. Our intent here is to make this a presumption of equal, a presumption of equal shared parenting. And at that time in 2006, Senator, now Judge Neville, said, and he also documented to the Minnesota State Court System Joint Physical Custody Task Force, has stated that 45.1% is considered equal. And since that's the basis of what we're trying to accomplish here, that's why we came up with that number. And again, it would not affect the child support guidelines at all.
I don't know if another... My question isn't really whether we have to change the child support statute to mesh with this proposal. My question is, what happens to the average case, like, where if people got divorced today and this weren't in effect, and versus if they got divorced and this were in effect, what changes in terms of the child support? What are the implications to that part of the case by making the change in the custody? And are you telling me there's no change in that?
Ms. Olson.
Maybe I'm misunderstanding your question. Maybe there's someone else in the lineup here that understands the question in a way that can answer it to your satisfaction. But right now, if somebody gets divorced and they decide they're going to have equal shared parenting, the child support would be the same today as it would under this bill.
Then maybe Mr. Ditburner can...
Mr. Ditburner, do you want to come back? I know you had raised the issue in your testimony, maybe. Mr. Ditburner?
Sure. Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Actually, prior to the adoption of income shares, custody and support were linked. If in cases of joint physical custody under the Hortis-Valento formula, the greater percentage of the parent at the time, if you have joint physical custody, the more the child support obligation would be reduced. What income shares would try to do is to get away from that by having three different strata of parenting time, 0 to 10%, 10 to 45%, and 45%+. And under 45%+, that would lead to the greatest reduction of child support. So I'm assuming that the intent in the statutory language, by using 45.1% plus and equating that with equal parenting time, that there was an intent to affect child support orders and to encourage reduction of those orders once there is equal parenting time being preserved.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hartman.
Mr. Chair.
Oh, Representative Scott.
Yeah, that was not the intent at all. Ms. Olson was part of this Joint Physical Custody Task Force, and that is what a judge came up with, and he defined it himself. I mean, that's what this task force came up with. It's defining joint physical custody as 45.1. That's why we used the number. It wasn't used to affect child support in any way. In fact, we're trying to be consistent. So there is no ulterior motive there to try to affect child support in any way.
Representative Mahoney.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Hortman. The 45.1%, if you go back and read Judge Neville's, where this particularly came from, in his remarks states to the fact, and it's relatively said in other places, I'll just phrase it that way, that if you all of a sudden go from 25% time or every other weekend and Wednesday nights and you all of a sudden go to 45% time, the cost of care of the child increases. So that does change some of that. So you would have the same standing as the other parent. You would have the same expenses, the same style of housing, food, clothing. So you're looking at being an equal partner, buying the clothes, buying the food, paying the tuition or field trip monies or whatever. So that's how that would change.
Representative Hartman, follow up. Yep.
Well, you know, what I'm trying to figure out is, why is it 45.1 and not 45? And I assume there's some significance to that because of the other legislation that we passed. And I don't think I'm probably super unique, but you know, what I'm trying to figure out is if I get divorced, and this is in effect, okay, my husband makes four times what I make. So before this statute, do we have an arrangement where we can actually both of us live the same as we do, you know, now and share the kids? And then after this, is there really no way for me to economically get a divorce? Am I kind of stuck? Because if I want to be with my kids half the time under this new model, the way that the child support would interplay with the other statute we adopted in 2006, I wouldn't be able to get enough child support to actually have my kids half the time. So what I'm wondering is, does this create an economic incentive for people to stay married because they simply can't afford to be divorced because of the way that it would impact child support?
There can be a radical difference under the current guidelines.
If you could use a microphone.
There can be a radical difference in terms of child support between the 45 and 45.01. I'm from memory, I just ran the other day, I think that the husband was earning about $6,000 a month, the wife was earning about $3,000 a month. When you punch the numbers, and I ran it both ways when meeting with the clients, I think child support was $900 a month when it was below 45.01. It went down to like $300 a month or $200 a month when it went over that magic 45.01. So practically speaking, it is a large change when you jump to that 45.01.
Representative Scott, any comment to Representative Hartman?
Well, Mr. Chair?
Representative Mahoney.
I'm not entirely sure, and I'm not a lawyer. I just play one at the Capitol. I'm better than some. My suspicion is at that particular point, spousal maintenance comes into play. And I know there's another bill rolling around here on spousal maintenance requirements, but the premise of divorce law is that both you share the assets, and in the child custody, the children maintain the same lifestyle. And just as if a judge had Charlie Sheen Kemp come in front of them, he would kind of understand the fact that Charlie's an out-of-control addict without any particular evidence beyond his TV commercials. I think a judge would figure out that you can't have two people that radically different, and the division of assets would be adjusted so. So your husband should beware.
Maintenance, however, will not correct this. I'll give an example. If you have a one-year marriage with a one-year-old child, a court is not, under the current statute, going to award 17 years of maintenance to make up that difference. So maintenance will not correct the problem.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Mahoney.
Mr. Chair, and just to the attorney there, I have a constituent in my district that just got nailed for 16 years of spousal maintenance until the child is actually through college. So, yes, the judge will appoint that.
It would depend on the facts. I have to know the facts of the case. That is in all likelihood, it was a longer-term marriage for that level of a maintenance term.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Mahoney.
Again, you know, I don't know all the details of the marriage. I don't think it was altogether that long, several years maybe. But, I won't get in.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Drazkowski, then Representative Holberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was helping Representative Scott as we, especially in the early stages of this bill, and I remember very clearly as we looked at that, we wanted to coincide the line in the same place on child support so that we wouldn't have, so we wouldn't interfere with the interpretation of what child support meant under the new system. Now this is equal and shared parenting, so that is the area that it made the most sense to drop that line, if you will. To drop that line anywhere else would cause confusion and cause need to revisit the child support area, which we didn't want to do.
Representative Holbert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is for Mr. Ditburner. We have your comments here in our packet, and one of the things that I struggled with initially was the standard of proof, the clear and convincing, and that being a pretty high standard, and he said, she said kind of cases, and you reference that concern in your letter as well. And so then I did some research and found out that that was, in fact, the same standard in CHIPS cases where you would have the state step in order to protect the child in some way from some real or perceived harm or risk. And so as I've thought about this, to me it makes sense that, I mean, you should have a pretty high standard in order to remove a child from a home by a government action. That makes sense. Why shouldn't you have that same high standard to deny access or parenting time to a parent with their child? Help me out here.
Mr. Chair, Representative Fulbert. The consequences of the CHIPS adjudication is perhaps having your children taken away from you, being placed in foster care, maybe even being placed in a county home. The consequences of having not 45.1% parenting time may be having 40% parenting time and still having a wonderful, full relationship with your child. So I don't think those circumstances are identical, and I don't think that in the latter you should have to have the clear and convincing standard. What about the mother that alienates and poisons her children against the father? She hasn't committed any of these different acts, you know, necessarily of abuse. You could try to call it emotional endangerment, but it's still a heavy burden of proof, just like with the abandonment issue. But it's a clear and convincing standard. And people will, you know, cast their behavior and characterize it in ways that sound antiseptic and not such a bad thing of all in order to not have it characterized as one of these CHIPS factors under the statute. I mean, there's lots of bad parenting out there that does not rise to the level of a CHIPS adjudication. And that's the point that I'm trying to make. And it's parenting, bad parenting, that should not result in somebody having equal parenting time.
Thank you,
Representative Holbert. Follow up?
No, thank you.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can someone answer the question? So if the child goes with one parent and the parent never gets that child to school on time, the child doesn't make it to school some days at all, would that rise to the level of a CHIPS petition under the current standard? So in this case, would reduce the amount from 45%?
Mr. Dittmer, or is that who the question was for?
I don't care who answers it.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom, I mean, they may point out simply that, well, the county hasn't classified our child as habitual truant, and that's habitual truancy, as I've pointed out, is not one of the factors that they have from this CHIPS statute. So, yeah, I don't see where that would necessarily be covered.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had a friend. Dad had custody of the child, and mom disappeared for, I don't know, 5 or 6 years. Mom did a lot of illegal drugs and disappeared, and then mom came back, went to treatment later on, came back, and decided that she wanted to, she sued for full custody of the children when she came back. Under this case, would that mom be entitled to this 45.1% presumptive of custody, even though she'd been missing for 5 years?
Representative Scott or Ms. Olson?
Mr. Chair and Representative Hellstrom, that's covered under the abandonment provision that we have on page 8.33. So she would have foreseeably, technically, abandoned those children she left for that period of time.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Hellstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So how long does the abandonment have to be in order to fall under that category?
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That is up to the judge.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hellstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I'm going to do the reverse. Now say dad has to go and work in another state because there is no work. For example, my husband went and had to work in Wisconsin twice for 6 weeks. If I would have divorced my husband at that point, could I have said he abandoned the children because he was gone for 6 weeks?
Representative Scott.
Chair Westrom, Representative Hillstrom, there are
many and various situations that this bill could not possibly articulate every single possible situation that could come up, and that's why there still is and will always be built-in discretion for judges.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The challenge is, in my opinion, previously it was always based on the best interest of the children. And so when you were doing this evaluation, you were always looking at the entire picture, looking at the kids, saying, what is in their best interest? This is now saying you are presumed to get this amount. Well, we would spend a lot of time talking about whether or not that was really abandonment, those 6 weeks that he was gone. Look, my kids are, you know, 17 and 21, and so this isn't really an issue for me. But in the event I wanted to make it difficult, I would spend a lot of time fighting over whether or not that 6 weeks that he worked in Wisconsin twice in 2 years, whether or not that was abandonment, because he couldn't come home, because he was working all the time. You know, he very seldomly, he worked the opposite shift of when they were around, so he couldn't call. So if that was an issue for me, I'd spend a lot of time fighting about those kinds of things. And so I just think that you have to be really careful about the standards that you put in statutes when you get away from the best interest of the child. And I'm very concerned about that in particular.
Chair Westrom, Representative Hillstrom, I understand your concerns, and I think it is important for everybody to think about all the various situations and how would they apply. We have gone to great lengths to think of all kinds of situations in you know, word for word, line by line. For 5.5 months we've been going through this trying to make sure that we cover those situations. And you know, when I hear you say that your concern is that this one area about geography could cause a battle and a conflict, well, I guess I would ask all of the committee to look at the best interest criteria, the 13 best interest criteria now that are solely used in custody battles. They are completely 100% subjective and arbitrary. Imagine the fighting that's taking place now with all of those. Every single one of them creates a battle.
Any follow-up, Representative Hillstrom?
Mr. Chair, my two points weren't really just about geography. Mine, the first one was about responsible parenting, right, and whether or not you get your kids to school and whether or not you do the right thing and making sure your kids are taken care of. And the second one was about abandonment, and if people aren't there and then they come back when they are presumed to have abandoned. So that isn't just necessarily about geography, right? Because I have a girlfriend, for example, who her daughter is now grown and gone as well, but dad was ordered 25% custody. Dad took a job in Montana, and guess what? Dad never came for his time. He never came for it. So his child support was based on the fact that he was going to come and do his share, and he never did his share. So what happens under your bill if something is ordered and child support is dramatically reduced because you get to that 45.1%, and then the other party, whichever it is, mom or dad, doesn't fulfill their fair share? What happens?
Ms. Olson?
Chair Westrom, Representative Hillstrom, I didn't mean to discount those other concerns you had. I thought the others on the panel had addressed those issues, so I didn't get to those other ones, so I don't mean to discount those. If you want me to elaborate on some of those others, other than just geography, I can and I will. But to address your most current issue here that you bring up on the modification, there is now and always has been, in current statute, the opportunity for anyone at any time to modify parenting time and modify child support. It's in there, and we are not impacting anyone's ability to do that in this bill. I would again refer to the packet that you were given. In the packet, in that same section where it's Minnesota specific, I have a handout in there about what happens if a parent's not fulfilling their time.
Representative Druskowski, then Hortman, then Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Ditburner, I was interested in your discussion about parent alienation, and given your position with the association you're involved with, I look forward to more discussion and maybe reading more about the advocacy within your association to bring the realities of the
the bad things that parent alienation does to families and to children, and I look forward to that. But I was also drawn to your suggestion that parent alienation would increase as we had a greater amount of shared parenting. Did I take what you had, your comments incorrectly? Because it would seem to me that the more parenting was shared, the less parent alienation that you would have. Is that characterized properly in your eyes?
Mr. Chair, Representative Drazkowski, no. I'm not suggesting that there would be greater efforts engaged in alienation. I was merely pointing out that that is not one of the factors. I know that there's a factor of emotional maltreatment, and people may say that alienation constitutes that. But these are really high standards in the CHIP statute, such as emotional maltreatment and abandonment. You know, and you have to prove it by clear and convincing evidence. And people will, you know, cast their behavior in terms of saying that I didn't engage in emotional maltreatment. If I had, then the county would have brought a petition to adjudicate my child as being in need of protective services. They haven't. So I'm in the clear. And that's the problem with these high, very, very severe standards, is that a lot of bad parenting, a lot of bad behavior isn't going to be caught here by these different statutory references. And when you get to the issue of abandonment, there are cases in which there are children born of one-night stands. And so a parent hasn't really ever had the opportunity to abandon their child. But if the county later brings a petition for adjudication of parentage, these people are going to be asserting their right to 45.1% parenting time. Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, thank you, Mr. Ditburner, and you're right, I didn't hear you correctly. But we all know that parent alienation is currently a problem that is not addressed. Some might argue not at all. Others would say very little. And so I would be interested in your perception. My perception is for those contested situations, that you've got two very strong, loving parents who both want to see and have access to their kids as much as they can. Would you expect then that if you've got a parenting situation A in which one parent has custody of the children 90% of the time and the other 10% of the time, and you've got parenting situation B in which it's 50-50, I would expect less propensity for parent alienation under scenario B. Would you concur with that?
Mr. Ditmer.
Mr. Chair, Representative Drazkowski, it's hard to imagine just based on percentages whether there would be less parental alienation. I mean, I guess my answer to that question is I don't know. I can't speak to that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Hartman, then Mahoney, and then we'll take a vote on the A11 amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, when we were discussing some of the questions, the author of the bill and Ms. Olson were saying that, well, that's up to the judge's discretion. But I'm in reading Subdivision 3, Overcoming the Presumption, I don't see anywhere where we give a judge discretion to use the best interest of the child to overcome the presumption. And so I'm not seeing where is any discretion given to a judge. And then, so if you could address that, where in this new statutory scheme is the discretion? And then the second thing is all these definitions come from the CHIPS statute. And so are you saying, and there's no definition in the CHIPS statute for abandonment. So has a child not been abandoned unless they've been adjudicated abandoned in a CHIPS proceeding? Or what is your intention in referencing the definitions from the CHIPS section?
Representative Scott or Ms. Olson?
Chair Westrom, Representative Hortman, two questions that you have. What about the judge's discretion and where is it? We do identify 518.17 is the best interest criteria. So for sure on line 9.32, it is right there in the geographic area, which I mentioned before. And also, if endangerment has been found on the next page on lines 10.1 through 10.4, that starts out on 9.35. If the court finds that the presumption has been overcome, we give absolutely full 100% discretion to judges in those cases. And we did that intentionally to alleviate any concerns that there might be that the judge's hands would be tied in those cases. And as far as the abandonment, there's been a lot of questions about abandonment. I mean, if we need to take the time to review those three statutes that we have in there, I'd be more than happy to do that. With regard to the definitions for
Ms. Olson, this is going to judiciary, assuming it passes out of here today. That's the next step. So,
Mr. Chair, then my final point would be, and it's not a question, the way that it's drafted, there isn't discretion. In Subdivision 3, in order to overcome the presumption under Sub 1, there either has to be some sort of child endangerment, or Sub 2, there has to be incompetency. Now, you've created another exception in Subdivision 4 where you've got geographic problems, and you've got your best interest of the child referenced down in there in the geographic situation. But Subdivision 3 says the only way you overcome the presumption of 45.1 and 45.1 is child endangerment or incapability, and there's no discretion referenced in that subdivision at all. So the only way, I guess, I as a mother could get those other factors to be considered would be if I move really far away, and then the judge can look at the best interest of the child because I've now created the geographic conditions so that they can look at the best interest of the child. So I think there's a lot of problems with the draft, Mr. Chair, and I hope members will be voting no.
Chair Westrom, if I can may just make one last comment. Representative Hortman, any time you go to court and you are addressing the court with any of these issues, they are the ones that will be making the decisions on all of these factors all of the time. So judicial discretion is there's no juries in these cases. It is up to the judge, for one thing. And second of all, we have to keep in mind that judges are only deciding between 1 and 5% of the cases. So it's a very, very small amount of cases where they are even put in that position.
Representative Mahoney.
Chair, I'll pass in the interest of time.
All right. Members, Representative Scott renews her motion on the A11 amendment. That's
Chair,
what we'll be voting on.
Did we move first to adopt that?
That's what we're going to do.
Okay.
We're going to adopt the A11 amendment or vote on the adoption of the A11 amendment because that's what our discussion has revolved around. I purposely didn't adopt this until we had discussion about what it did and how it modified the bill. All those in favor of the A11 amendment, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed, same sign?
No.
Motion prevails. Members, we now have the bill in front of us as amended, House File 322. Is there any last burning questions? Otherwise, it is going to judiciary. We have another testifier that's here for the next bill we are hoping to get to. Any final questions on House File 322 as amended?
Mr. Chair, I would just say, you know, there might be discretion that judges use today, but under this new standard that's being proposed, that there is no room for discretion, and so I hope members will vote no.
Any further questions, comments? Having none, Representative Scott renews her motion to pass House File 322 as amended, and we refer it to the Judiciary Committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign?
No.
Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Scott, and to all the testifiers. Representative Mazerall, 1198 members, hopefully we can move through this one pretty quick and avert any need to come back tonight or Wednesday. There is a testifier that's here for the bill. Representative Mazerall moves House File. Moves the approval of a passage of House File 1198. Representative Mazerall. Let me start that over. Representative Mazerall moves the passage of a House File 1198 and refer it to the Judiciary Committee. Representative Mazzarol, if you want to give us a real brief overview of your bill, and then I understand you have a witness from that's come here, and we'd like to have them testify, and hopefully we can vote this out today.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's correct. And there is an amendment that's been passed to the committee, Amendment A11, which is really some clarifying language that I would like to move. Adopt.
Let's move the A11 amendment. Representative Mazzarol moves the A11 amendment to get the bill in the shape the author intends. Any questions? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. To the bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Committee. House File 1198 refers to the Uniform Interstate Family Support Act. This is a bill that addresses the uniformity of rules and jurisdictional standards for enforcement of family support orders. It's been proposed by the Uniform Laws Commission and is supported by the Minnesota State Bar Association. And for testimony, Mr. Chair, I brought with me Judge Harriet Lansing.
Mr. Harriet Lansing, Judge Lansing, welcome to our committee. If you want to just identify yourself for the record, please proceed.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. We are mindful of your time constrictions, and we will be able to function very well within them.
And just identify yourself for the record.
Okay. I'm Harriet Lansing. I'm a judge of the Minnesota Court of Appeals, and I am a commissioner of the Uniform Laws Commission, and it is in that second capacity that I'm here today.
Very good. Welcome.
Thank you. As Representative Mazzarol said, this is supported by the Uniform Law Commission. I am a Minnesota commissioner on that commission. I'm here on behalf of the commission to present a very brief overview of House File 1198, the proposed changes to Minnesota statute sections 518C101 through 518C616. As you are aware, this is an act to update the Uniform Interstate Family Support Act. So essentially, we're talking about effective enforcement of family support obligations among states and now among international states. Minnesota's current Child Support Act is based on the Uniform Laws Commission's 1992 Act, which was enacted in Minnesota in 1994. Since then, there has been one update in 2001, which provided for greater specificity in the event that we have multiple orders that were issued for child support. The current update, which was approved by the Commission in 2008, is for the purpose of incorporating international provisions. I know that you're generally familiar with Uniform Law Commission, and I just wanted to say a couple of things about that. Uniform and Model Acts are researched by the Uniform Law Commission. We're an organization that was created in 1892 to preserve viable state law within the federal system. These statutes are created by commissioners from each state who serve without pay and are appointed by the governments of each state. When enacted, the laws are directed at facilitating interstate legislative goals and to reduce transaction and litigation costs. And we have examples, which I'm sure you're familiar with, most notably is the Uniform Commercial Code, and also we have a number of business entity acts that we have worked on. We have also been active in the child support area. The changes that are included in this act are for the purpose of incorporating the provisions of the Convention on the International Recovery of Child Support and other forms of family maintenance that was concluded at The Hague in November of 2007. As part of that, to incorporate also the 2002 changes. The bottom line is that these changes will make it easier to obtain enforcement of child support orders, not only across state borders but international borders. And the changes also assist in determining the priority of orders when we're dealing with multiple jurisdictions. Mark Ponsol, Assistant Ramsey County Attorney and Ramsey County Child Support Director, is here and can speak to very briefly to the need and the efficacy of the changes. And Julie Erickson from the Child Support Enforcement Division of the Department of Human Services is also here to help answer questions about the effect of these changes. Jerry Williams, who of the Minnesota State Bar Association Family Law Section, is also here, and that section has endorsed the act and I should say the Minnesota State Bar Association has effectively endorsed the act, as has the American Bar Association. Because of the integrating fabric of state adoption and the importance of that, legislators sometimes want to know what's happening in other states. So before I turn this over briefly to Mark to speak about the efficacy, I can report that the act has been passed in Maine, Nevada, North Dakota, Tennessee, Utah, and Wisconsin in 2009 and 2010. It was signed into law on Friday in New Mexico. It's been introduced in Florida, Hawaii, Missouri, Rhode Island, and Washington this year. That concludes my testimony, and I'll now give up my chair to Mark Punsell.
Very good. Thanks, Ms. Lansing.
My name is Mark Ponsole. I'm an assistant Ramsey County attorney. Thank you for letting me appear in front of this committee. I'll be very brief.
Very brief. Thank you.
I have spoken with Barry Blumgren from Hennepin County. Hennepin County supports this. Ramsey County supports this, as well as various child support attorneys who I work with on a regular basis. From the perspective of the counties and, I believe, the state as well, passage of this uniform law will enhance our ability to deal with other countries. Right now, a county specific has to deal with another country, or the state has to deal with another country. This way, all the counties and the states will be dealing with the various countries in a similar fashion. Thank you.
Are other countries adopting this then in order to have a reciprocating agreement? Is that fair to? Is that the
yes,
correct
Mr.
understanding?
Chair. Yes, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Any questions from members? Representative Duskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just curious, what type of autonomy and authority are we ceding to other countries with this? And that's what it appears to me as we are doing. Can you help me out with that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Drakowski, I'm not sure exactly what your question is, but I'll try to do my best. What we're allowing is, if we got a Minnesota child here, we can more efficiently obtain child support from, let's say, the other parent who went to Germany. As a result, the quid pro quo is if the child's in Germany, they can procedurally more effectively deal with our state in trying to collect child support from the other parent who happens to be in our state. So to turning over power to them, I'm not sure exactly what you mean by that. If the power, if you will, has been turned over by the United States government entering in a treaty with the country of Germany, this bill allows us to carry that out.
Thank you.
Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This, as I understand, we're going to lose funds on this if we didn't pass it by last year. So how much have we lost?
The federal government has not yet mandatorily required it as a condition of receipt of federal funds. We anticipate that. I think Judge Lansing has something to add on that.
Yes. Judge Lansing.
That, Mr. Chairman, Representative, that's absolutely accurate. We're a little bit ahead of the curve on this, just so we won't be put in a position where we would lose funds. So that if we are now in a position to go ahead as the other states have, and to make it the effective date conditional on the federal legislation, then we will not lose any funds.
Okay.
Representative
Mr. Chair, so then, Judge Lansing, what's the drop-dead date then? I'm not sure I caught that in there.
Judge Lansing.
Right. We are currently a signatory to the convention, and the way in which the convention is being ratified is by passage within the states. The drop-dead date has not yet been determined, and it will be when the Congress has passed the legislation that will require the compliance within the two-year time period.
Okay. And then last question, Mr. Chair, if I may. So who do you have working on this in the Senate then?
Who's the Senate author?
I don't have the answer to that, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Tennyson?
Representative Lesh.
We'll go to Representative Hoppe. In the meantime, you might get the answer passed to
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I have a number of questions for the testifiers. I will ask them afterwards. I'm a co-author on this. I think it's a good idea. And I would hope they can stick around for a minute in the interest of time.
Okay. Any other questions, members? Judge Lansing, basically, there's about six or seven states that have passed this, about 40-some that have yet to do that. Is that a rough estimate?
At least six or seven, and it has been introduced in, let's see, two, four, five, six more. And usually, as it has been in the past with the Reciprocal Enforcement Acts, they pretty much go forward, and we don't have any states that remain as outliers, partially because of the funding integration. But we're just starting now in the enactment process.
And at this point, Congress hasn't put a drop-dead date on, and you would anticipate when they pass a law that references this, there's going to be a two-year window that it has to be passed within?
Mr. Chair, that is absolutely correct. And as we know, they've been dealing with other things, major import lately, and so the capacity to move some of these things forward has slowed down a bit.
Sure. Representative Mazzaro, do you have a comment?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Lesh. I have just been informed that there hasn't yet been introduced a Senate file.
Representative Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Lansing, should we enter into this, what is our ability to revoke our participation, or whoever could answer that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Ruskowski, let me make sure that I understand in terms of revoking our participation. You mean that at some point in the future we would not want people in Minnesota to be able to obtain child support from obligated parents who were living in another country?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Ruskowski.
If it doesn't work out, I mean, if this arrangement, and I'm still looking at parts of the details of the bill, but if it's something that seems to not be in the best interest of Minnesotans, and there's some problematic parts to it, once we enter into the arrangement, is there the ability to exit the arrangement?
Judge Lansing.
Commissioner Tennyson will speak to this.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I'm Robert Tennyson, attorney in Minneapolis. I'm also a uniform law commissioner. I think once the United States ratified the treaty and once they have implementing legislation, that's the law of the land. And what Congress did in the past was choose this as a method for implementing the legislation or implementing the treaty. So we don't have a choice as a state withdrawing from a treaty. The purpose of this, is, as Judge Lansing, as Commissioner Lansing has mentioned, is to make sure that Minnesota citizens are properly treated in the enforcement of child support, one way or another. And this isn't with every country. You know, it has to be a recognized country by the federal government that has the proper kind of laws and standards in place to make sure that it's fair and meets due process. So the answer to the question, if I understand it right, is a state does not have a right to withdraw from any international treaty. That, under the federal constitution, the ratification and implementation of a treaty is a federal law. There's different ways you implement a federal treaty. Some are self-executing, you don't have to do anything. Some are done through federal legislation, that's how they implement it. And the third way is to ask the states to do it. This is a method by which we've asking the states to develop the implementation of the treaty as a way to preserve states' participation and interest in the matter.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Driscoll.
Real quick, thank you, Mr. Tennyson. And Judge Lansing, I owe you an apology. I heard Representative Westrom say Lansing as I was reading through here, and I thought it was a mister, so I apologize.
Right.
Thank you.
So, Mr. Tennyson, to that issue, basically once all 50 states have adopted this, the treaty then is executed.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I wouldn't say 50 states. What the federal or international law requires is that every country that participates or agrees to a treaty exercises good faith in implementing the treaty. And whether it's 49 or 50, I'm not sure it makes a much difference. But if we anticipate that that's what will happen, and since every state in the country, and plus District of Columbia and Virgin Islands and some others, adopted the current Uniform Interstate Family Support Act, we'll expect that all will.
Very good. Any other questions, members? Representative Hoppe. Passes. Having no further questions, anybody in the audience have a burning desire to testify for or against this legislation? None? The chair will renew Representative Majerol's motion to pass House File 1198 and be referred to the Judiciary Committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Members, that completes our agenda for the day. The meeting is adjourned.